Blog Talk Radio.
So I'm gon' drop you with the left, the left. I feel like I'm the last real nigga left, the left. It's like I'm on an island by myself, the left. Please don't make me slap you with the left, the left. You a fake, so I'm gon' drop you with the left, the left. I feel like I'm the last real nigga left, the left. It's like I'm on an island by myself, the left.
Start up a bit. What's up, people? Welcome to the show.
Okay, jam-packed Tuesday show for y'all. We got the corporate Democrats taking out the knives for people who are against the Syrian new front in the war. We're going to discuss that. We got the New York Times wrote another fluff piece on CNN. I will rip that to shreds in a variety of ways. We have the immensely, colossally weak Democrats and their preemptive concessions to the Republicans, which are just gratuitous and asinine and wholly unnecessary. And then we had a shooting yesterday, which was terrible. We'll get to that a little later on in the show. And Hillary Clinton, out of the woods, literally, talking about misogyny in the election. Oh, boy. And Sean Hannity and his insane level of hypocrisy. So we got all that and more. Buckle up. Going to be a long ride today. Let's start with Syria and some of the fallout from that. The corporate Democrats have taken the knives out for Representative Tulsi Gabbard. This is from CNN here. Liberal leaders call for challenge to Gabbard over serious skepticism. They say a pair of veteran leaders on the left, so-called left, former Democratic National Committee Chairman Howard Dean and Center for American Progress President Neera Tanden, called on Hawaiians to vote Representative Tulsi Gabbard out of office after the Democrat questioned whether Syrian President Bashar al-Assad was responsible for last week's chemical attack. Quote, people of Hawaii's 2nd District, was it not enough for you that your representative met with a murderous dictator? Will this move you? Tanden tweeted Friday in response to Gabbard's comments on CNN that she is skeptical Assad is responsible for the chemical attack. So first of all, let's pause here and all laugh together at the fact that Neera Tanden, who of course is Hillary Clinton's henchman, she's just outraged. I'm aghast. This is morally offensive that you would meet with a murderous dictator. You do know that, for example, the Saudi absolute monarchy is a theocracy and a dictatorship. Are you outraged when every top U.S. politician meets with them? I mean, look, Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, so she met with way more murderous dictators than Tulsi Gabbard ever did. But of course, you know, it's double standards, it's hypocrisy all over the place. It doesn't matter. Not only that Hillary met with these people, because whatever, she was Secretary of State, she had to, but that she praised many of these people. I mean, when you're praising Netanyahu, as Hillary has, when you're praising Henry Kissinger, I mean, these guys are murderous psychopaths. But no, in Neera Tanden's mind, all my outrage is saved for Tulsi Gabbard for meeting with Bashar Assad. Now, furthermore, the fact that they're angry over some people asking questions, like, stop and think about it. It's our intelligence agencies that are saying, Bashar Assad, oh my God, he did this chemical attack. It's so hideous. It's so horrendous. I can't believe that he did this. This is crazy. Yeah, like our intelligence agencies would ever lie. I mean, is that really what we're supposed to believe now, that our intelligence agencies are benevolent and altruistic and just objective empirical fact finders? The CIA has most recently been in the spotlight for what? Oh, I don't know, their giant torture scandal that they tortured and they covered it up. You know, the whole agency is built on overthrowing third world governments, democratically elected third world governments, and putting in fascist puppets to do the bidding of our corporations. So now I'm supposed to put all the history, all the skepticism aside and go, you know what, I think the CIA and the NSA and all of our intelligence agencies are being really objective about this. Now look, I don't know if Assad did the chemical attack or not. I do know it's mighty convenient that they say he did, because remember, 2 years ago, Assad gave up his chemical weapons. He gave them up. There was a meeting with a Russian official and John Kerry. It was a press conference. The Russian official said, look, how can Assad make us say you don't attack him? Because at the time, the U.S. was saying, hey, you cross the red line, we're going to attack you. And Kerry said an offhand remark. He was like, well, look, if he gives up all of his chemical weapons, then we won't attack him. But that's not going to happen. And then Assad was like, here, take all my chemical weapons. So the guy gave up all of his chemical weapons. He's basically in a position where he already won the war in terms of the rebels are in tatters, they're a shell of their former selves, and they really can't win. So it was like a Hail Mary pass where they said, oh, see, we need U.S. intervention. Look at what just happened. Assad did a chemical attack. So a guy who gave up his chemical weapons did a chemical attack, and it was when he had already won the war, and it was a gratuitous, asinine attack on civilians. Yeah, I think skepticism is definitely merited here. They go, nope, you have to say Assad did it. You have to believe our intelligence agencies because they're so trustworthy. And then obviously the logical response is, well, we got to go to war. We got to, you know, these are people who, at best, some of them said, oh, I mean, Trump needs to go to the Congress. And on procedural grounds, I object to his bombing, though I think he's right to do the bombing. But hey, man, you got to follow the process and go to Congress first. That's the best case scenario that the corporate Democrats are saying. Worst case scenario is, I'm for it. Nancy Pelosi was like, yeah, no, we had to do it. Chuck Schumer was like, yeah, it was a good idea. So we have this so-called opposition party, hashtag the resistance, who are like, you know what? We're not going to resist Trump. We're going to resist the people who are resisting Trump, like Representative Tulsi Gabbard. Let me give you more. Gabbard told CNN on Friday that she wants to achieve peace in Syria. What a bitch. Quote, why should we just blindly follow this escalation of a counterproductive regime change war? There's responsibility that goes around, Gabbard said. Standing here pointing fingers does not accomplish peace for the Syrian people. It will not bring about an end to this war. Gabbard has also said she is concerned about sparking a nuclear war with Russia, which backs the Assad regime. So think about what she's saying. She's like, look, man, regime change, disaster. We've had a history of it, and every time it's been an unmitigated failure. Whether you talk about Iraq and Saddam Hussein, whether you talk about Gaddafi in Libya, I mean, how much more evidence do you need that when you overthrow the strongman in the Middle East, even if the strongman is a horrible person and doing horrible things, you create a power vacuum, and oftentimes, historically, that vacuum is filled with even worse people. So she's saying, hey, regime change, kind of tried it, kind of a bad idea, how have we not learned our lesson yet? And she's also saying, you know, maybe you don't want to get involved in Syria in this way because you're escalating with another nuclear armed power. If the Russian government backs the Assad government and you go in there and start attacking Assad, and for example, Russian planes are at their air bases and you attack the air bases, well, you know, maybe there's going to be an accident one of these days. Maybe you're going to kill Russian soldiers. And what happens when that happens? Nobody wants to be there for that. But Neera Tanden and Howard Dean, the so-called leftists, they're not leftists at all, they're corporate Democrats, they're all angry. Oh, I can't believe this. How dare you disagree with our overtly hawkish far-right president and us, and we're serving the military-industrial complex. Don't you dare disagree with us. You know, we're going to come after you. So the knives are out. They're going after Tulsi Gabbard, and Tulsi Gabbard is 100% right. Regime change is not a good idea. Escalating with Russia is not a good idea. And remember, it's just, at this point, the position of people like Howard Dean and Neera Tanden, it's incoherent. Because they simultaneously argue Trump is a Russian puppet, he's Vladimir Putin's puppet, and he's doing his bidding. And then, on the other hand, they look at the fact that he's attacking one of Vladimir Putin's top allies, which is a direct escalation with Vladimir Putin, and they act like, number one, we're for that action, number two, that doesn't contradict the story that he's Vladimir Putin's puppet. Well, then nothing contradicts that. That is a non-falsifiable claim in your mind. No amount of evidence could prove that theory wrong that he's Vladimir Putin's puppet if you decide that Trump bombing one of his top allies, you know, isn't evidence of that. So of course, you're going to have, here's your resistance, here's your brave Democrats. They're coming for the few dissenting voices that are saying, hey, maybe another regime change war is not a good idea. Again, I don't know. It's like we have the shortest memory of all time because Saddam Hussein, I mean, look, when people said, hey, we shouldn't go into Iraq and topple Saddam Hussein, it was the same smears trotted out against those people. Because what'd they say? Oh, you're defending this murderous dictator, aren't you? That's what you're doing. It's fucked up, man. I can't believe you like Saddam Hussein. Think he's a great guy. I mean, these were the smears that the neocons used, that the Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, that they used against the few dissenting voices who said, I don't think it's a good idea to topple him. Well, now they're doing the same thing with Assad. You know, you say, hey, I don't think we should do a regime change war. Of course I condemn gas attacks, but I'd like to know who really did it and where the actual evidence is. But I don't think we should do regime change war. And what do? Same thing. Ah, you're apologizing for a murderous dictator. You would think that the people who were most in bed with Hillary Clinton, whose biggest list of failures is being in favor of all these regime change wars and voting for them, you'd think that maybe they'd be hesitant to say, yay, rah, rah, let's do it again. But no. But no, they're impossible. They're incapable of doing self-criticism. And it comes through here. And it's hilarious because they're calling for, you know, a primary of Tulsi Gabbard. No, you know who's actually going to get primaried? All the corporate Democrats. And we're doing it. JusticeDemocrats.com. Read our platform. Sign your name in support of the movement. Guys, it's really, 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 really important. Because we're primarying the corporate Democrats. They think there's going to be some grassroots pressure and there's going to be somebody who pops up who could defeat Tulsi Gabbard in a primary. It's not going to happen. They have fucking pipe dreams. It's like they're saying, you know, this is akin to them saying, so, you know, we should really primary Bernie Sanders. Why? Because you don't like him? Because you're a corporate sellout? That's not going to change anything. You're not going to get the people to actually vote that way. They're a house of cards, and they're full of shitty ideas, and this makes it crystal clear. Okay, next. Bitch. The New York Times wrote another fluff piece on corporate media this week. They absolutely, positively heaped praise on Jeff Zucker. They drowned him in affection and love. So let's break down some of this. They say, absent a war or a natural disaster, Zucker cast around for an event that might capture the national attention. For 24 hours, the network went all in on a cruise ship that was adrift with a broken sewage system and then devoted weeks to the mysterious disappearance of a Malaysian airplane. Don Lemon interviewed a llama in prime time. The era of searching is over. Zucker has found a story to ride, the biggest story we could ever imagine, he says. And as it turns out, the only thing better than having Donald Trump on your network is having him attack it. Okay, let me pause here for a second. So, Jeff Zucker, of course, the head of CNN, he was in control of the Today Show. He led the Today Show, and he got them incredible ratings. Now, what made CNN think, well, a guy who ran an unserious show that was successful, the Today Show, should take over a serious network that's supposed to do news and politics like CNN is beyond me. But perhaps they care only about ratings and they don't really care about the substance of what they're talking about. But so they have Jeff Zucker take over CNN. And Jeff Zucker is a child. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's got his eyes closed and he's throwing haymakers in the dark hoping to hit something. Now, at first, this is what happened. They described it here. He's talking about poop crews where, oh, my God, the sewage line is broken and the cruise ship is going slow. Literally, for a full day or maybe 2 days, that's all they spoke about on CNN. You know, the ship is going really slow, and we got the cameras on it, and, oh, boy, is this wild. They're doing phone calls with people who are friends and family members of the people on the ship. It was hilarious. I mean, everybody mocked it. Left wing, right wing, doesn't matter who you are. Everybody's going, this is the dumbest fucking thing I've ever seen in my life. The missing plane, they must cover that for a week, 2 weeks, whatever it was, where Don Lemon speculating, hey, maybe the plane went into a black hole. they would have no new information, but they would only cover that. See, this is the first trick of Jeff Zucker. The trick is breaking news the shit out of everybody, because you got to put that on the banner, breaking news, and then it could be the most banal nonsense shit ever. Because what they found is, it's a fact that CNN is the number one place people go for breaking news. But what they did is they would take things that weren't really important and shouldn't have been breaking news, and they overplayed their hand. So, for example, one of the things they put was, breaking news, the Titanic sank 102 years ago today. Okay. That is, without question, the dumbest breaking news banner in human history. But this is Jeff Zucker. It's all tricks. You know, what he does is the equivalent of somebody's really, really tired. So the network CNN was really, really tired under their previous leadership. And Jeff Zucker comes in and he doesn't say, hey, you know what we need to do? We need to get a good night's rest. We need to go into the wilderness a while here, retool, and then come out a better network and then basically rebuild from scratch. What Jeff Zucker did is he came in and he said, hey, here's a Monster Energy drink, here's a Red Bull, here's a couple gallons of coffee, chug this shit, and then when you feel that zip, you're going to go, oh, look, okay, well, everything's great now, we're doing a great job, and see, isn't everything wonderful? I fixed everything. No, you didn't. What you're doing is fake. Those are fake good ratings when you're breaking news and nothing happened. So that was his first trick. Now, then he moved on to his second trick when that failed. Okay, we had the election. They gave billions and billions and billions of dollars in free media to Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton got like half the coverage Donald Trump did, and everybody knows I despise Hillary Clinton. Okay, so this isn't a defense of Hillary Clinton as much as it's to say the coverage was disproportionate. And, you know, when they attacked him and they covered him with all this free media, the attacks were stupid. Like, oh my God, he uses naughty language, which made a lot of people like him. Because they go, oh, look, he's like me. He's a regular guy. He's saying fuck you to the establishment, seemingly, even though he is the epitome of the establishment now that he's president. But they would use shitty arguments against him. They would cover him nonstop. Of course, Bernie Sanders. They would rather show an empty Trump podium than a Bernie Sanders speech. So this was his second trick. You know, hype up Trump, cover him nonstop, and it's all PC outrage coverage and just to try to get eyeballs. So now let's continue and see where it goes from here. They say, far from hurting CNN, Trump's war against it has amounted to a form of product placement, earned media, you could say, giving its anchors and correspondents starring roles in the ongoing political drama, turning them into camera-ready warriors for the First Amendment. Zucker has not shied away from the conflict, which has been reassuring, even inspiring to his staff. I hate to sound like a fanboy, but he's the best boss I've ever had, Tapper, a former senior White House correspondent at ABC News, told me. It has also been good for business. Last year, CNN's average daytime audience was up more than 50% and its primetime audience 70%. The network earned nearly $1 billion. All right, let me pause there. This is one of the main reasons why this article and all the other fluff pieces on Jeff Zucker are so incredibly disingenuous. They're bragging about an increase of 50% to 70% in ratings during the election. Guess what? Literally every political show in the world on every platform is up at least that amount. At least Secular Talk was up way more than that. Why? Because it's an election, you fuckface. How do you not get that people are going to tune in and watch more news and politics during an election? But they make it seem like they all put it on Jeff Zucker, like, oh, Jeff Zucker, genius. If it wasn't for him at CNN, it would have, you know, the ratings wouldn't have gone up at all during an election and the craziest election of any of our lifetimes. Okay, if Jeff Zucker wasn't there, there's a chance that the coverage went up 100%. So, like, how did they not, that basic fact is overlooked in the article, and it might be on purpose, because they're just doing fluff pieces for their other friends in corporate media. That's what this is. So that is so misleading. Oh, Jeff Zucker saved the network 50% to 100% to 70% increase. If I was the head of the network, it would have been a 400% increase. Are you kidding me? There's nothing to brag about. It was an election, the craziest election ever, and they're bragging about a 50 to 70% increase? Everybody in news and politics had their numbers increased, and most of us probably more than that. Okay, more. Zucker is a big sports fan, and from the early days of the campaign had spoken at editorial meetings about wanting to incorporate elements of ESPN's programming into CNN's election coverage. The idea that politics is sport is undeniable, and we understood that and approached it that way, he told me. Toward that end, the network built pregame sets outside debate halls with excited crowds in the background and created a temporary rooftop studio for the final weeks of the campaign with sweeping views of the White House and the Washington Monument, and an on-screen countdown clock tickled down the days, then hours, to November 8th. Trump, the trash-talking and trash-tweeting underdog who inspired raw, powerful feelings among supporters and detractors alike, was the ideal subject for this narrative framework. Okay, so this is the crux of the problem. Jeff Zucker is not a serious person. He's not a journalist. He's not a news guy. He's not even a political commentator, because all the people who are those things read this and are embarrassed and feel shame and disgust. Because, you're doing tricks to try to increase ratings. So now the main mission of CNN is not, okay, we're going to give you the best information, the best data, the best news, the most facts, the most context, the most education about the world and what's going on and why certain things are important. They're not going to focus on serious issues affecting real people to try to shine a spotlight on it to make it better so that maybe there's a grassroots rising, and then people get involved and call their congresspeople. They're not doing any of that. No, they're saying, we want to make it look like ESPN, pretty much. We want people to debate, take two arbitrary sides of a fight that's kind of made up and have them duke it out as if there's a real philosophical difference when it's just a show. Look at how far they've fallen. This is a joke, man. And then I can't wait. It's happening. It's probably already happening right now. But give it a little bit of time, man. There will be just an utter implosion of CNN's ratings, because, again, it was all fake because it was the election, the increase. Everybody experienced it. The difference is shows like mine hold on to the numbers because we're actually doing something that has value. They're not doing anything that has value. When you take fucking, Jennifer Granholm, corporate Democrat extraordinaire, and have her debate Rick Santorum, you know how people react to that typically? Because it's the fake left, the fake right. I'm going to give you 2.5 minutes. Go ahead, duke it out, and it'll be on some non-serious issue. So this isn't a long-term strategy for having a solid network and a news network. This is tricks, and this is effectively cheating to try to get eyeballs, but you're getting eyeballs by not doing your job. So don't tune in to CNN if you want to see, maybe coverage of the fact that half the country, 50%, makes $30,000 a year or less. You know, that seems like a serious issue they might want to focus on a little bit, but no talk about that. You might want to talk about the fact that there's a $54 billion increase in military spending that Donald Trump wants, even though we already spend 54% of discretionary spending on the military. Seems a little disproportionate to me. You might want to cover the fact we have 800 military bases around the world at a cost of $100 billion a year, and that's more than the next 8 biggest militaries in the world combined. You might want to talk about that. You might want to talk about the drone war and that there's a 432% increase under Trump. You might want to talk about the massive numbers of civilian casualties in every single military strike Trump has taken since being in power. You might want to talk about the fact that 45,000 people die every year because they don't have access to basic health care. All these serious issues that require, number one, spreading those facts. We have over 400,000 homeless people in the United States of America, and to house the homeless people would save the taxpayers money. Might want to talk about that? No talk about serious issues affecting real people. Let's make the coverage like ESPN. That's his take on it, and he's getting disgusting, grotesque praise as a result of it. And then, at the end of this all, we come to the main fact here. As they're writing this sick fluff piece, guess what? There was a Gallup poll. Came out recently, about 6 months ago. Trust in media is at an all-time low. Just 32% of the American people trust media. Trump has a 35% approval rating. Hillary Clinton has a 35% approval rating. which means the media, CNN leading the pack, they're less trusted than the proven corrupt corporate liars, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And in the midst of that fact, you have fluff pieces being written in the New York Times about how Jeff Zucker saved a network because ratings went up during a fucking election. I've never seen a bigger joke than this. The fact that they run this and they're not embarrassed at the New York Times is beyond me. I mean, really, nobody, none of the editors involved in this, none of the writers were like, hey, hold on now. A 50 to 70% increase, virtually everybody in politics had a minimum 50 to 70% increase because there's an election. You know, hey, maybe we should talk about the fact that Jeff Zucker is admitting he's not going to focus on substantive issues, and he's going to try to make it like ESPN. None of that. So, and then, wow, would you look at that? Again, isn't it amazing? It just so happens to, coinciding with this, YouTube just demonetized virtually their entire news and politics division, but especially ones that are controversial and offensive, like yours truly, me. So think about that. And oh, wow, also, isn't that convenient? YouTube rolls out YouTube TV as they demonetize independent creators in news and politics like myself. And then you go look at who's taking part in YouTube TV. It's just TV. So YouTube comes up with this new thing. Oh, my God, it's so great. It's free. It's open. You got independent creators. They offer something new. People flee TV. They unplug, and they come to YouTube, and they go to the Internet, and then YouTube, the geniuses running it, go, yeah, I got an idea. How about we turn ourselves into TV? I'm not kidding. Go look at who's part of YouTube TV. It's all just TV. So people went from TV to go to YouTube, and then YouTube goes, how about we fuck over all the independent content creators and make ourselves TV again? It's like the creator of the telephone going, I got this great new product. It's called the Morse code. Want to use that? It's like the creator of the car going, you know, we're rolling out a new product called the horse and buggy tomorrow. So we're the roadkill. We're getting fucked over. And also, wow, it looks like Donald Trump wages another offensive war against a country that didn't attack us. The media fawns over it, as you've seen. Zero articles critical of it, 18 in favor of it, according to Fairness and Accuracy in Media, in reporting, Adam Johnson. Wall-to-wall positive coverage, Brian William, the missiles are beautiful. Fareed Zakaria, you know, oh, he became president today. Wall-to-wall positive coverage of an offensive war against a country that didn't attack us. And again, at the same time, defund, demonetize, kneecap, independent, free media. That tells you the truth. Like myself, like David Pakman, like Jimmy Dore, like all of us. So the main way we're funding the show now, patreon.com/secular talk. Patreon.com/secular talk. We're going to fight back against all this, man. Are you kidding me? I ain't going anywhere. We're going to fight and we're going to fight and we're going to fight and we're not going to bend our will. We're not going to filter or censor our coverage or tweak it or change anything. We're going to be right here. So the funding is a little different. We get it $2 a month from you lovely people, which works out to about a cent per video. Fine by me. You wanna go ahead and kneecap us, YouTube? Well, we have other ways of making it work. So patreon.com/secular talk, and also use our Amazon link. And I'm technically, according to the Amazon terms of service, I'm not allowed to tell you to bookmark it, but I'm leaving this portion of my commentary blank so you can assume what I'm telling you to do. So use our Amazon link if you already shop on Amazon. If you don't shop on Amazon, don't worry. But if you shop on Amazon, use our link and help out if you can, patreon.com/secular talk, because I can't tell you how infuriated I get reading articles like this in the New York Times, which basically are blowing Jeff Zucker for the horrific job that he's done, taking a hatchet to the face of news and data and information and politics and what's supposed to be objective empirical coverage. Okay. Next. So the Democrats are immensely weak. They're already plotting a preemptive surrender and concession in a fight that hasn't happened yet and, in fact, is years in the future. Watch this.
Institute the 60-vote rule, can they? Hit the shoe, and when the shoe is on the other foot, do you expect Democrats to reinstitute the 60-vote rule, can they, if it's such an important aspect to the Senate and confirming Supreme Court justices?
Well, when the Democrats return to the majority and capture the presidency, which we will, that day is going to arrive, we will restore the 60-vote margin. We will ensure that for the Supreme Court there is that special margin that any candidate has to reach, because that is essential to ensuring that our country has a confidence in those people who are nominated, rather than just someone who passes a litmus test.
Okay, that was Ed Markey, a Democratic senator. That's one of the saddest things I've ever seen. Now, you might say, well, this is a one-off thing. It's just one Democrat saying it, and it's in passing, and whatever. No. Chris Coons of Delaware said it. I think Chuck Schumer hinted at it. It's a thing. There's a bunch of them who are going, no, that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to bring back the 60-vote threshold. So let me get this straight. Obama, Justice Scalia dies, what, with a year left in Obama's time in office? A year, almost a full year. And so Obama says, okay, I'm going to do my job and appoint the next Supreme Court justice. We're going to go with Merrick Garland. Now, Merrick Garland was already an olive branch or a fig leaf or whatever the thing is that means you're looking out for the other side. He gives that to the Republicans by saying, Merrick Garland, a very centristy kind of judge. You know, he's got some real questionable votes when it comes to due process of law, you know, like Guantanamo Bay. He kind of sided with the conservatives on that. When criminal justice, he kind of sides with conservatives. Money in politics, he kind of sides with conservatives. He's just better on, like, social issues. He's progressive. He's liberal. But, like, very – I mean, this is, like, the exact kind of justice that Republicans should want a Democrat to pick. So Obama does that in typical Obama fashion. I went off because I was like, what are you – why would you preemptively just put somebody progressive and push, 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 fight, fight, fight? But he picks somebody they'd like, and then they go, no, we're not going to have it. And the Democrats are like, what are you talking about? We got, you know, over 300 days left in his time in office. What does that mean? And we're not going to – we don't care. We're against him. So not only were they against him, they didn't even have a preliminary hearing. Like, there's a few steps before they get approved. They said, we're not even having a hearing. So it's not like they had a hearing and then eventually they got to a vote and they voted him down. They just said, no, we're not even going to hear him. That's it. We're just not going to allow it. They more than doubled the record for obstruction for Supreme Court justice. That's incredible. So then Trump gets elected, and Trump fills the vacancy. First of all, the Democrats immediately, okay, let's have a hearing, like, tomorrow. Great. Totally cool. We're not weak bitches. Okay, we're having a hearing tomorrow. So they have the hearing. You know, obviously he clears the hurdles. It gets to the Senate. The Democrats band together enough to the point where they say, okay, we're going to filibuster him because it's a 60-vote threshold to get through. He would need 60 votes to get through. And so Mitch McConnell goes, that's cute. We're just going to get rid of the filibuster. I mean, think about that. Like, this is how the Republicans play. Hey, when we're in charge, I'll blow up the system. I'll do whatever. I'll twist arms. I'll cheat. I'll do whatever to get through and to win here. So that's what they do. Say, okay, so he got through with, what, 54 votes or so? He wouldn't have got through if it was the 60-vote threshold. And by the way, the Democrats, it's not like they didn't have any options then. If I were the Democrats, I would have done, there's a comment period before you vote on it. So I would have said, okay, we're just going to keep talking and not shut up. And it's basically an unofficial filibuster at a time when you're not supposed to do it. Which makes it even better, because then you get more press, you get more attention, and you could get your talking points through more because you hammer them home. And you say, hey, here's the problem, and then you list them off. He wanted a trucker to freeze to death in his vehicle when management told him, hey, stay there, but he needed to move in order to survive. He's against euthanasia in all cases, even if you're terminally ill and you want to die and your family's around you and you want to go peacefully. You know, he sided with management over labor almost all the time. Get your talking points ready, go out there and hammer them. The Democrats didn't do that. But now, after the Republicans have sufficiently spit in the face of the Democrats, slapped them across the face, bent them over their knee and shoved a broomstick up their ass, the Democrats go, may I have another one, please? Because they say, as soon as we get back in power, we're going to bring back the 60-vote threshold. So they get to jam through whoever they want when they're in control, and then when you're in control, you bias the rules in favor of them even more. If they want to play by these rules, you go, okay, let's play by these rules, and then when you're in control, you jam it down their throat. Say, oh, we just appointed Noam Chomsky to the Supreme Court. Have a nice day. But of course they're not going to do that. Number one, they don't believe in a guy like Noam Chomsky. They're not actual progressives. They're corporate Democrats. So they're a joke, and they're a shell of what the Democratic Party used to be. But also, I mean, all they do is concede. That's all they have in them. That's all they have. They're weak. They concede. They think, the nicer I am to them, the more it'll work out. No. No. So they screw you over. They change the rules to bias it in favor of them. And then when you get in power, you go, yes, now we are also going to bias it in favor of you. So whenever there's a Republican president, we get a far-right justice. Whenever there's a Democratic president, we get, at best, a centrist justice. So there's never a progressive, there's never a liberal. JusticeDemocrats.com. You got to be sick of this. If you're not sick of this, then just face it. What you are is you're maybe a centrist or center-right corporate kind of person. You're not a progressive. You're not a liberal. No progressive, no liberal could look at this and go, that's right. I agree 100%. The Republicans get whatever they want. When the Democrats get in power, they make it even harder for them to succeed. For them, meaning the Democrats, to succeed. So Republicans bias it in favor of Republicans. Democrats get in there and bias it in favor of Republicans. I have no words for the colossal weakness and stupidity of the Democratic Party. You have to go to JusticeDemocrats.com, sign your name in support, because we're running candidates. We're primarying the corporate Democrats. And we're primarying them because we want to have real progressives and liberals in there who will fight for what you want. Okay. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the shooting. Then we're going to move on to Jeremy Scahill ripping CNN over Syria. And then later on in the show, Martin O'Malley goes after Bernie Sanders, and you're not going to believe what he had the nerve to say. Do not miss that story, man. All right, stay right there. We'll be right back.
God knows that I don't deserve what you put me in.
At an elementary school yesterday in San Bernardino. Three people are dead, including the shooter. CNN says a Southern California man fatally shot his estranged wife inside an elementary school classroom attended by special needs children before killing himself on Monday, San Bernardino Police Chief Jared Bergwan said. Two students were injured in the murder-suicide at North Park Elementary School in San Bernardino, and one of those children later died at a hospital, Bergwan said. Bergwan said the shooter, Cedric Anderson, 53 years old, of Riverside, walked into the classroom armed with a large caliber revolver and opened fire without saying anything, killing Karen Elaine Smith, 53 years old, also of Riverside. Smith was a teacher at the school. So they say he wasn't aiming at the kids at all. He ended up killing his estranged wife, his ex-wife, and there was one kid who died because the kid was near his wife and a few other that were injured. But, you know, this is a heartbreaking situation, and you think, how can anybody go into a special needs class? I mean, obviously, how can anybody go into any class? But there's like a whole nother level of like, oh, really? When it's a special needs class and, you know, do something like this. So here's an interesting fact of the story that almost every outlet is leaving out. He was a pastor and a devout Christian. So David McAfee from Patheo says this. On March 14th, Anderson posted a rant about black churches and so-called pastors. He goes on to assert that these black churches, which have experienced an influx of former gangsters, pimps, and hoes, and the simple-minded are, and I quote, filled with witchcraft. The brainwashed can't let go because they, their grandparents, their parents, have all spent a lot of money keeping the lies alive. They are not free in Christ, but filled with guilt, hurts, and secrets that have crippled their life, so they stay. They stay in that bondage because they were taught or brainwashed into believing they, if they support the pastor no matter what, God is going to bless them. It's sad, like the street gangs of our cities, every pastor and church has their own banner of color or colors of Jesus. I just pray for them and keep my guns close. So this is a recurring theme on his Facebook page. It was up yesterday. I don't know if it's still up today. But the theme is, guns, guns, guns. He talks about his gun. And there's a lot of, like, allusions to violence, but also a lot of religious stuff, too, overtly religious stuff. I mean, that line about they're all filled with witchcraft. These evil people are filled with witchcraft. So, you know, look, it brings up an interesting point in that when you had the case of the atheist, what was it, last year, maybe 2 years ago, there was a guy who was like a strident atheist online. He would post atheist memes all the time. And then he ended up killing a young Muslim couple. And immediately the media basically said, hey, it's because of his atheism. He's an atheist, and it's because of his atheism. They didn't bother to actually make a connection or do any more fact-finding or research. They said, atheism, atheism, atheism is a problem. Atheism, atheism, atheism. It's because of his atheism. Just immediately. In this case, we have a devout Christian who's a pastor who's saying stuff like, they're filled with evil and they're witchcraft and I keep my gun by me, not a mention. The only people that mention it, Patheos, about Christianity. So you see the double standard? When it's an atheist who does something wrong, it is by definition the atheism. When it's a Christian who does something wrong, it is by definition not the Christianity. See how that works? And by the way, I'm not saying it definitely is the Christianity in this case. For all we know, it could be mental illness. It could be a mix of fundamentalist religious beliefs and mental illness. You know, it all depends on the facts of this particular circumstance, and we don't have all the facts in this particular circumstance. But it is interesting that in one case, the media jumps to conclusions. In the other case, not a word about his religion, because, hey, I'm a Christian. We all know that these Christians, and, you know, my family, they don't act like this, and they're Christian, so it can't be Christianity. And, of course, I don't even need to get into it for Islam. I mean, by definition, if there's a crime, any kind of crime committed by a Muslim, it is because they're Muslim. It is Islam by definition. So there's double standards here. When it's an atheist or when it's a Muslim, the default assumption is that's why. It's because of atheism and it's because of Islam. When it's a Christian, never because of that. So the coverage of this has been poor. Now, when it comes to gun laws, California has strict gun laws. So this wasn't necessarily a failure of you can't pin it on lax gun laws necessarily. But what you can say is, and this is the same case with every time the right-wingers point to Chicago, for example. They go, oh, my God, the shooting's in Chicago, but they already have strict gun laws. Therefore, gun laws don't work. That's the argument they make. But that's misleading because what happens is all around Chicago, they have lax gun laws. So people drive right out of Chicago, get the weapons, and bring them back into Chicago. Same case with California. You know, okay, so you have strict laws there. You go a state over, they don't have as many. They don't have strict laws like they do in California. It's more lax. The more rural you get, the laxer the gun laws. And to an extent, that makes sense. Of course, it's a different lifestyle. Some people hunt and they eat the the food that they hunt. And but that's the reality of it is they'll try to pin it on tight gun laws led to the shooting somehow. But no, it's because you have lax gun laws all around the area, and then they just go and get it and bring it back in. So if we were to have, for example, at a federal level, a really strong universal background check, would that have prevented this? Probably not. I mean, there's a chance because if they really wanted to dig into his history and see he's a little off his rocker with, the witchcraft, the evils, and we got to fight back against it, and I got my gun, maybe they would have been able to catch that, but probably not. So I don't know if gun laws is the answer in this situation. But I feel horrible for the people that passed away. Of course, this is a grotesque situation that unfolded yesterday. Unfortunately, it's all too common in the U.S. And unfortunately, we always have to deal with these media double standards and biases. Okay, next. Go to Jeremy Scahill. Journalist Jeremy Scahill went on CNN to discuss what's happening in Syria, and he decided to take a chainsaw to their face.
Jeremy, I think there is awareness of what's been going on in Syria, but for some reason, maybe people are desensitized. What is your view of the coverage?
Well, first of all, let's look at this in the big picture. Donald Trump has given greater latitude to the military to conduct strikes with almost no regard for civilians. Just in the month of March, Brian, U.S. and allied forces have killed more than 1,000 civilians in Iraq and Syria, according to the nonpartisan independent group Air Wars. Trump is funneling weapons and intelligence to the Saudis that are being used to utterly destroy Yemen at this point. The United States has been engaged militarily in Syria for several years now, both in the form of special operations forces and increasingly conventional boots on the ground, but also just scorched earth bombing, particularly since Trump took office. And I have to say, Brian, that Arwa Damon is a fantastic reporter. I have great respect for her, but I think when we talk about this, CNN needs to immediately withdraw all retired generals and colonels from its airwaves. You know, Fareed Zakaria, if that guy could have sex with this cruise missile attack, I think he would do it. Brian Williams seemed to just be in true love with the cruise missile strike and in a despicable way invoking Leonard Cohen's name. I mean, the media coverage has been atrocious, particularly, and this is across the board on every network, particularly when the strike is happening. It's like they're in awe of the cruise missiles. And look no further than Hillary Clinton, Bill Kristol, and Donald Trump once again being on the same team when it comes to these kinds of wars. The elite of both parties just all get in line, and they absolutely love a cruise missile strike.
Hot diggity damn, Jeremy. Hot diggity damn. So first of all, random side note here. I feel like a dick for saying this, but I think it's true. Man, Scahill's aging. I think the stress of all the shit he's been through. I mean, he did that amazing movie where he went to Somalia and he went to talk, you know, Pakistan and Yemen. He went to talk directly to the people who've had family members just obliterated by U.S. drone strikes. And, you know, these people were innocent. And he's immersed himself in this on a daily basis, probably even more than me. And I'm immersed in it 24/7. And it's catching up. Oof, it's catching up. So, Jeremy, man. Give yourself a little treat day. Go to a spa. Get some sort of mask that purifies the pores, something. Man, it's catching up to you. But anyway, so apart from Jeremy Scahill's looks, which is wholly irrelevant, yeah, he's 100% right on every point he made there. So this idea, like the fact that the media is buying into the framework of, well, but Trump says he's trying to protect civilians. That's why he did what he did in Syria. Okay, but all, you have to do just the teeniest amount of research to debunk that. Literally one Google search will debunk that. Trump doesn't care about civilians. He said during the election, we have to take out their families. We have to take out their families. So saying, let's kill the families of ISIS. Grandmas, grandpas, aunts, toddlers. Babies. Hey, we got to take out their families. What are you going to do? This is the guy who said that. This is the guy who, in his first raid, killed an 8-year-old American girl. 30 civilians died in his first military raid. It was a raid that Obama didn't approve because Obama said, hey, man, this is too, this is a little too up in the air. And Obama wasn't really a stickler for civilian casualties either, so you know it was bad intelligence on that. Never mind the 200 civilians that the U.S. just killed in Mosul in an airstrike. So the list goes on and on. Virtually every strike Trump has done has killed civilians. There's been a 432% increase in drone strikes as well. So it just takes a little bit of research to find out that this guy doesn't care about that. He's arming Saudi Arabia as Saudi Arabia massacres civilians in Yemen and does a blockade of Yemen where now 17 million people are on the verge of starvation. So they're going to pretend like, oh, chemical weapons are, you know, violating the norms. Well, then why are we giving chemical weapons to Saudi? They use white phosphorus. Why are we giving it to Israel? Israel's used that in Gaza. So it's just pathetic. They're supposed to fact check and give you information in the media, and they're just doing wall-to-wall propaganda. Like Jeremy was alluding to there, Fareed Zakaria said, this is the moment he became President Donald Trump for doing an attack. Brian Williams said, these missiles are beautiful. The missile strikes are gorgeous. And that's, you know, this is why Scahill said that Fareed Zakaria, it sounds like he wants to have sex with the missile. He would have sex with the missile if he could. Yeah. Brian Williams probably would have a threesome with the missile and a tank or something. I don't... That joke did not land. but what you're seeing here is you have the military-industrial complex, but now part of that complex is the media. Because like Jeremy alluded to, you have people who are retired colonels, retired generals, who now come on the airwaves and give their opinion like they're, you know, it's an expert's opinion. But you do a little digging and you find out they're all on the payroll of defense contractors. So they're always going to be for more war because they make more money if there's more war, and they want those contracts from the government. They're looking out for their companies. They're paying them. So this is a really, really sick system that we have set up here. And Jeremy Scahill absolutely ran roughshod and called out all the bullshit, which is why he probably won't be let back on CNN anytime soon. Okay, now we go to Martin O'Malley. Do-do-do-do-do. Martin O'Malley. This guy's a prick. Martin O'Malley is back in the news. He's the former governor that ran for president for about 13 seconds. He ran as a Democrat, for those of you who don't know, because, again, nobody knows Martin O'Malley. I think his wife is like, who? Martin who? I don't follow. It's a competition for who's sadder, Martin O'Malley or Jim Webb. It's close. They're neck and neck. But anyway, so look at what he said. Martin O'Malley, Bernie Sanders wouldn't have beaten Donald Trump. But right underneath that, but the former Maryland governor says, if he had been the Democratic nominee, I think I would have won. Huh? Martin O'Malley, he once did a rally or a meeting, and one person showed up. Literally. Martin O'Malley tried to get votes by giving out free pizza. And then when people came for the free pizza, he stood up on a table and started talking about how, you're going to put me over the edge to win. I think it might have been in Iowa that he did this. Martin O'Malley, who his rhetoric was almost as progressive as Bernie. It wasn't. But he was like, on a spectrum of Hillary Clinton being a right-wing Democrat and Bernie Sanders being, you know, a left-wing Democrat, a democratic socialist, somebody who actually cares about the issues, Martin O'Malley was a little bit more on the end of the spectrum towards Bernie Sanders. And he's also much younger than Bernie Sanders. So you would think that a guy that's pretty progressive in his rhetoric, and he's younger than Bernie, that he would be the one that gets, oh my God, the horde's coming after him. No. You want to know why? Because he's a horrible politician and a terrible candidate. Martin O'Malley would have been great in like 1988, you know, back when there was this, people seem to want the kind of milquetoast, boring, fake-ass politicians that only use talking points and have that tired rhythm and cadence of, now let me tell you something. I'm here to represent the American people, and I'm pointing at you like this because pointing at you like this, poll testing shows, is too aggressive, so I'm doing this because my advisors tell me to do this, and I'm going to say things that I've been taught to say in the way I've been taught to say them. Back then, back in the day, he would have done well. But now there's an era where there's a rawness and a realness to people that I think kind of went hand in hand with the rise of the internet. Like, the more free, open, available flow of information there is, the more people seem to be leaning towards, fuck the bullshit. I want somebody real who I trust, who's just talking to me like a person. So Martin O'Malley was the opposite of that. But again, Bernie Sanders, he was that. He was the real person, the raw person. Let me tell you what I think. These billionaires have destroyed our country. We're going to get money out of politics. We're going to do something to fix income inequality. We want a living wage. We want single payer. We want free college. People went, that guy's real. I know he's 1,000 years old. I know he's got bad posture. I know he's got a heavy accent. I don't care because he's real. So Martin O'Malley has never been more wrong about anything in his entire life. And it's really sad. And he's trying to stay relevant. By the way, relax. It's okay, guys. O'Malley says he might run in 2020. Dude, give yourself a break. His ego has to be so bruised after, like, -3 people voted for him and liked him. Don't do it, Martin. Don't do it. Don't do it. But he might do it. But furthermore, let's just, real quick, I mean, I don't even know why I need to get into this because I've covered this 1,000 times. But, you know, I'll cover it 1,000 more if it means people learn. There's a reason why everybody says Bernie would have won. It's because the evidence says he would have won. So first of all, Hillary Clinton. It is true that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by 3 million votes. But she lost the general election, or she lost the Electoral College, obviously. Now, the reason why is the Rust Belt flipped from what was considered a Democratic firewall, which means, oh my God, we're so convinced we're going to win it that Hillary didn't even campaign in some of those states. It fell, and it went for Donald Trump. So you look at the numbers, and it's only like 80,000 votes or so that decided the election in the Rust Belt. Well, guess what? They would have went for Bernie Sanders easy. Because Bernie Sanders had every bit of the anti-establishment appeal that Donald Trump had, minus the baggage of the bigotry and the xenophobia of Donald Trump and the fact that he's a buffoon and he looks like a clown and he's a reality star. So you have a guy who's populist as fuck. You have a guy who looks out for the people, a guy who's anti-establishment, and his record proves it. And then you got a reality show clown who's mimicking that and pretending to be populist and pretending to be against these trade deals. Bernie would have eaten his lunch. If all he had to do was flip 80,000 votes in the Rust Belt, it's not even close. Of course Bernie would have won. Who are you kidding? And furthermore, the polls, the fucking polls, man. So Bernie won on average. When you did all the polls, Bernie Sanders versus Donald Trump, on average, Bernie was up about 10 percentage points. In some polls, he was up 15%. So that's not, like, that's fucking nothing to scoff at. That's a gigantic lead. Now, you say, well, hey, man, the polls, they could be off. I mean, look what happened with Hillary. But the polls with Hillary weren't that off. Again, she won the popular vote, but she lost the election because she lost the Electoral College. But Bernie's popular vote lead was way above and beyond what Hillary's was, that there's a giant cushion there. So, and furthermore, you go to even states that are tried and true red states. Bernie would have given Trump a run for his money there. Why? Because even though Bernie is a democratic socialist and he wears that banner proudly, Bernie won in like Kentucky and West Virginia and all these different primaries and caucuses in the Midwest. Because they polled people on the way out, and they said, yeah, I'm actually pretty conservative, but I voted for Bernie. So it turns out the labels are irrelevant. They just hear what the guy's saying, and they like him. When he says, I want to raise the minimum wage, I want to bring back strong unions, I want to do single-payer health care, Medicare for all, that people go, even if they're conservative Republicans, many of them go, you know, I agree with that. Because people aren't as mired in the labeling nonsense as the Washington bubble media is. So there's like a 1,000 reasons why people say Bernie would have won. Guys, he is literally the most popular politician in America. Literally. That is literal. So there's been multiple polls. When they ask, okay, the different constituents in the respective states, hey, how do you like your senator? Least popular is Mitch McConnell. His constituents hate him. Most popular is Bernie Sanders. His constituents love him. What's his approval rating among his constituents? 83%. 83%. So that means so many conservatives in his state say, yeah, I love the guy. I might disagree with him on some things, but I love the guy. Then furthermore, so forget the respective state thing because you say, okay, that's his constituents. So of course they're going to like him more than the general population. Wrong. The general population, again, he's number one in the country. General population, I think 61% or 62% favorability rating for Bernie Sanders. What's Donald Trump? 35. What's Hillary Clinton? 35. He's the most liked politician in the country. He keeps showing the Democrats the way to win, and they keep spitting in his eye. And now you have Martin O'Malley. Like, what, do you not believe in math? Do you not believe in numbers? People say he would have won because there's so much evidence pointing in that direction. It's not like, in their mind, it's a bunch of butthurt Bernie bros who are listening to Vladimir Putin, and Vladimir says, tell them that Bernie would have won. They're like, yes, Vladimir, Bernie would have won. No, we're looking at the fucking polls, dipshits. So stop with your terrible arguments, you know, about, oh, no, he wouldn't have won, but I would have won, even though negative 8 people liked me. Piss off, Martin. You sound ridiculous. Next. We move along, bitch. Hillary Clinton. Let's do it. Hillary, ooh, what the fuck? Loud, random computer noises. Hillary Clinton sat down with Nick Kristof of the New York Times at the Women in the World conference, and she was asked a question about misogyny in elections.
On this theme of misogyny in elections, one of the most common questions that I got when I asked followers was from an enormous number of young women who, frankly, were galvanized by your loss in a way that they had not been galvanized by your campaign, and they want to go out
right.
and change the world,
right.
in many cases by public service, but they're anxious about the nastiness of being in public life, especially for women. And in some cases, I think they're concerned about the research that some social scientists have pointed to, that women can be perceived as either likable or as competent leaders, but not as both.
Yes. Yeah, be ready. It is not a new phenomenon, but it feels new and painful every time it happens to you. And so one of my favorite Americans, Eleanor Roosevelt, said, good grief, 70 years ago now, more than that, that every woman who enters the public arena needs to grow skin as thick as the hide of a rhinoceros. And boy, do I relate to that. Because the research you just referred to, Nick, and Sheryl Sandberg wrote about this in her last book, Lean In, but many, many academics have written about it. And it's a pretty simple but unfortunate phenomenon. With men, success and ambition are correlated with likability. So the more successful a man is, the more likable he becomes. With a woman, guess what? It's the exact opposite. When I think about, I left the State Department as Secretary of State. I had like a 64, 65% approval rating. People thought I had really done a good job, which I was, you know, very touched by. And it was a job that I was asked to do by a man, President Obama, right? So I did it to the best of my ability and came out, and some people said at the time, the most popular public official or high-profile public person in politics in the country. Well, what happened? Oh, my gosh, you know, by the time they finished with me, I was Typhoid Mary. And poor Mary, I mean, she didn't deserve it either when you go back and look at the history. Part of the attacks, the personal attacks, part of the bullying, part of the name-calling that has certainly become much more pervasive because of the internet, is to crush your spirit, to make you feel inadequate, to make you doubt yourself. And I just refused to do that, and that infuriated them even more.
You're using it as a shield, Hillary. That's the problem. So is there any reasonable person on the planet who would say, sexism doesn't exist, it's not a thing? Of course not. Of course not. But what you're doing is you're taking the fact that people don't like you because of your record and because of your corruption, and you're deflecting and you're obfuscating and you're saying, well, no, it's actually just because I'm a woman. How many of the people who refused to support you voted for Jill Stein? How many of the people who refused to support you would have voted for Elizabeth Warren? How many of the people who refused to support you would support Tulsi Gabbard? Like, it comes across incredibly disingenuous, because it is disingenuous. Because what you're doing is you're trying everything in your power to not do introspection and find out, well, why do people really not like me? It's got a lot more to do with Hillary, the fact that, you know, you were the candidate from Goldman Sachs. You were the person who took, what, $625,000, $675,000 from them to give a few speeches. You know, the Clinton Foundation and all the money they raised. Did you know that the Clinton family, all together in their political careers, they've raised $3 billion from special interests? Now, you're going to look at us and tell us, well, we're not corrupt. How dare you say that? So what? We raised $3 billion. But we're not stupid, Hillary. And then when we disagree with you and we're angry because of the money you raised and because of your vote and because of your support, you supported NAFTA, you supported TPP and lobbied for it 45 times. You voted for the Patriot Act. You voted for the Iraq War. You supported regime change in Libya, what you did in Honduras. The list goes on and on. So we give you this mountain of substantive reasons why we disagree with you, and your response is, well, you know, they want me to doubt myself because of this subconscious sexism that they have, and I'm just not going to do that, and that makes them even more mad. It's the policy, Hill. you had a layup election against a candidate that was a joke of a human being. The guy said, I grab him by the pussy, I don't even wait. He's admitting to sexual assault. He said, we have to take out their families during his campaign, saying I'm going to kill civilians on purpose in the Middle East. This is a guy who outsourced his own jobs to 15 different countries. And somehow he came across as the more populist candidate. Now, let's be clear. Now that he's in office, he's the most establishment candidate ever, and he appointed Goldman Sachs everywhere in his administration, and he's a giant sellout, and he's a neocon. He's acting in horrific ways. I want to be crystal clear about that. But the fact that that guy was able to be more convincing than you were about his populism and about his anti-establishment streak, what are you going to do? You're just going to blame everybody? It's because people are just sexist, you know? But then just prepare to keep losing elections then, because that's what's going to happen. You're just shaming people. Oh, you know, you're sexist and you don't like me for that reason. And you're refusing to look inward and then make changes moving forward. And that's also keeping the party back, because it's her minions who are still in control of the party. The DNC, Tom Perez is leading it. Ardent Hillary supporter. Backer of TPP, Tom Perez is. Stacked the DNC with all former Hillary staffers, people who've proven they lose to Donald Trump. Now he has them leading the resistance against Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton came out the other day and said, yeah, it would be great if we bombed Assad in Syria, and then Donald Trump did it. So you have to go to the issues. Guys, what was it, like a majority? There's I forget the exact number, so forgive me. We're live here, and it just popped in my head now. But so you have, I think, a majority of women, but it's a certain demographic, either, I think, older women or women over a certain age, a majority of them voted for Trump over Hillary. So, Hillary, is your claim that, well, I mean, come on, they're just sexist. That's a dodge, and that's obfuscating, and that's deflecting. And, you know, I think we'll see just how not true that is in the next election, if we were to get an Elizabeth Warren running against Trump. Now, I have my problems with Elizabeth Warren. I'm sure many in the audience do, too. I was furious she didn't endorse Bernie early on, yada, yada. I can go into a million things. But she's way more progressive than Hillary. You know, she did the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which has helped regular people massively. She's pushed Glass-Steagall, bringing that back. She's been against interventions, yada, yada. So I think we'll see just how wrong Hillary is if Elizabeth Warren runs. I think we'll see if Tulsi Gabbard or some other prominent woman who's actually progressive decides to run. And again, this is not to say that sexism doesn't exist. Of course it does. But you're using it as a shield, Hillary, and that's the problem. And it's also hard to take you seriously and you're concerned about this issue when you've taken millions of dollars from Qatar, from Saudi Arabia, for the Clinton Foundation. These are governments that, especially Saudi Arabia, is the worst. I mean, they cover women up. They say they're not allowed to drive. They need male guardians to go out in public and go about their business. I mean, these are like officially just state-sanctioned sexism. The laws are openly sexist. And you're going to take millions of dollars from them. And then, by the way, arm them, give them sweetheart deals when you're Secretary of State. And when you wanted to be president, you would do the same thing. And then you're going to turn around and cry sexism when certain people don't vote for you. It just strikes me as hollow because it is hollow. So look in the mirror, please, or go away. Why is she still out there talking? Maybe she wants to run again. I don't know. But either way, your time has passed, and it's a good thing it's passed. Okay. Next. The Alabama governor, Robert Bentley, which, by the way, is a hilarious name because it sounds like he's one of those con artist preachers, the televangelist who tries to, you know, pretend that, hey, my holy water cures cancer and debt. Pay me and your debt will be cured. Ah! Robert Bentley. So he quit yesterday, and he was supposed to face impeachment charges, but he resigned right before. So he also pled guilty to two misdemeanor charges. One of them is failing to file a major contribution report, and the other one is knowingly converting campaign contributions to personal use. So what brought him down? Well, it was an affair. He was boinking his senior political advisor, Rebecca Caldwell Mason, And in trying to cover it up, he threatened to prosecute people and harass them and threaten their jobs. And he also spent about $9,000 on lawyers for her, among other things, probably. So his wife found out, and close advisors and aides found out, and then he, you know, he was trying to cover it up by any means necessary and threatening to prosecute people and spending money on her. And so, yeah, it's a mess, and he's a terrible guy, and it's great that he stepped down. He actually was guilty of a few felonies, but he made a deal where he's just pleading guilty to two misdemeanors. But here's the angle of the story that really annoys me, because this is like, there was a CNBC show that used to be on. I don't know if it's still on. I forget the name of it, but what they do is cover financial criminals and say, oh, look at this horrible criminal, like a Bernie Madoff, for example. Stole all this money from these innocent people. Horrendous. But they'd cover that, and it would actually kind of be a diversion tactic, because it's like, hey, look at this exception that proves the rule that everything usually functions so smoothly and normally, and there's nothing creepy going on Wall Street. It's just the occasional criminal that every time gets out, but then we always catch him. It's the same thing with this. Like, oh, look at this one-off, you know, corrupt politician, and it's so rare to have corrupt politicians, and so he's the bad one, and he'll step down, but then there's no other problem. Don't look any deeper. But, okay, the real reason this guy got caught is because of his affair, and because he was kind of brazen in attempting to cover it up and threatening people's jobs and whatnot. That's the only reason this guy got caught. I mean, guys, Mike Pence, who's now the vice president, did the same thing, took campaign contributions and converted it to pay his mortgage and to pay for personal stuff. Now he's the vice president. So this idea of like, well, you know, he's the exception that proves the rule, that the rest of them are honest. None of them are honest. We have a system of legalized bribery in the United States of America. Politicians take money from corporations, and it's under the guise of campaign contributions, and then when they get in power, they vote in favor of those corporations to get corporate welfare checks, to use offshore tax havens, to get all these sweetheart deals, favoritism. And then it's paid back by the corporations continuing to give them campaign contributions the next time they run. So the worst candidates who sell out the most are propped up by the system. The honest candidates are left behind because it's harder to grassroots fund, although now that dynamic is changing and people are really trying to do that, which is a good development. But overall, we still need to get money out of politics. But then the other angle to it is when they're out, then they're hired as like lobbyists, and they sit on their ass all day and make 2 phone calls a month to their buddies in Washington. And they get paid at like $500,000 a year or $1 million a year. That's the revolving door. You go to work for a corporation, work for Wall Street, work for a financial institution as a lobbyist, except, hey, that's illegal for a certain number of years, so we'll just change your title. You're not a lobbyist. You're a vice fucking assistant president or some shit. Okay, so now that's totally illegal. You actually do lobbying, and you sold out to us when you were a politician, so now we're going to look out for you and give you money to sit on your ass. That's the way this system works. Yeah. Politicians are bought. They're an investment. You give them campaign contributions, it pays back a lot more through the tax breaks they get you and special deals that they get you. So they're worth $500,000, $1 million a year when you get $800 million in tax breaks. So that's the way the system works. And yes, this guy, I'm glad he got brought down, and he's a horrific guy. But it all blew up only because of his affair. All the other politicians are corrupt too, but they do it within the guidelines of what is legal, and so they get away with it. No, we got to get money out of the system, because there's a reason why Congress has an approval rating of like between 8% and 15%, because they're not representing you. So that's the real scandal. The real scandal is right in front of your face, that they're all corrupt, and we need to fix that by getting money out of the system. Okay. Next. Tommy Lahren is suing The Blaze for wrongful firing. Lahren's lawsuit claims her decision to express her opinion is not a for-cause ground for suspension or termination. It also says Beck is known for berating, belittling, and acting in a condescending and heavy-handed way towards Lahren, who joined The Blaze in 2015. The suit also states that the defendants, Beck and The Blaze, are refusing to give Lahren administrative control and access to her own official Facebook page, which they currently control. Lahren's page has 4.2 million fans and hasn't been updated since March, causing irreparable harm, according to the suit. It's not yet clear whether Lahren has a solid case against Beck and the Blaze. She has an arbitration clause in her contract that seems to prohibit lawsuits, and Texas has no laws against political affiliation discrimination. Lahren is looking for a temporary restraining order for freedom of speech, along with payment of her attorney fees, as well as all other relief, which she may show herself justly entitled. Okay, so we discussed this a while ago. She was temporarily suspended at that point in time, but now she's officially been fired. And she's suing Glenn Beck as a result of her firing. She's saying, hey, this is a wrongful termination suit. So Tommy Lahren went on The View and said, hey, look, I'm pro-choice, and I'm pro-choice because I believe in small government, and I kind of believe in it across the board. If I don't want the government telling me I can or can't have my gun, I don't want them telling me what I can and can't do with my body. So she said they're hypocritical if Republicans are against abortion. And that pissed off people at the Blaze, but I actually think the story is deeper than that. So that's the surface-level thing. I think the reality is there's multiple angles to it. So first of all, are they mad about that? Yes. They say, Beck claims, no, that's not why I'm mad. No, that is one of the reasons why he's mad. But another aspect to it is the Blaze is in a financial free fall. They're making no money. They're propped up by right-wing think tanks who give them money. That's like they're welfare queens. So they don't make money in the free market. If you look at the ads on their channel, it's all like survival kits and just advertisers that don't pay much, that aren't enough to keep them on the air. So they're propped up by the right-wing think tanks. So they don't want to pay anymore to Tommy Lahren. So they view this as like an opportunity to get out. And furthermore, I think Beck is jealous. I think Beck is jealous. Beck was on top of the world when he was at Fox News. He was on the cover of like Time Magazine and all. He was a big thing. And oh my God, he was a conspiracy lunatic clown on Fox News. But he got national recognition. And he was so famous. And then he was just a fall from grace because the Blaze, it was like dwindling into irrelevance. They've always been a small level channel that doesn't have a deal with all the different carriers. So, look, Tommy Lahren is probably now more popular than Glenn Beck, and Glenn doesn't like that. So I think it's because Glenn is jealous, I think it's because of what she said, and I think it's because they're in financial trouble and they're looking to throw people overboard. So that's what I think is going into it. Now, in terms of who's right legally Beck is right, because if you're a private company, you're allowed to fire people for almost any reason. I mean, you can't fire somebody, hey, you're black, I'm going to fire you. You can't fire somebody for race, you can't fire somebody for religion, you can't discriminate based on gender. So some certain things you can, of course. But for most things, if they say something you don't like, you're under no obligation, I'm going to keep you here. No, you can say, I don't like what you said, I'm going to fire you. Totally legal. Totally legal. So Beck is right legally. I don't think her case is going to go anywhere. But that being said, Beck is being a real douche by not giving her Facebook page. Because let's face it, the Facebook page is popular because of her. She had a lot of videos go viral on Facebook. So for them to say, well, you know, now us, your former employer, are going to keep this, that's just a fuck you move. That's a spiteful move. And that's a move for Beck to say, I'm trying to put out the fire and make her less popular than me again. So that's a dick move. Look, if I'm a judge, I'd say just give her the fucking, come on, give her access to her own goddamn Facebook page. But I also find it funny that Tommy Lahren now all of a sudden believes in workers' rights. Isn't that cute? Like, she would argue, if this was anybody else, she'd argue, of course the company can do whatever they want, free market, they're allowed to fire somebody. But when it's her, workers' rights, let me sue somebody. I thought Republicans were against these, you know, frivolous lawsuits, and they're for the owner class and the business being able to do whatever they want. Well, when it affects you, it turns out to be a little bit different. So, look, overall, I think it's a mixed picture. If I was Glenn Beck, I wouldn't have fired her. But then again, if I was Glenn Beck, I wouldn't have hired her in the first place because she's full of shit. She's a liar. But Beck is full of shit and a liar, too, and they're ridiculous people. So it's hard for me to even comment on it because my philosophical disagreements with them, among my just basic editorial standards, are so different from them that it's like I can't even really comment on it. But I wouldn't have fired her for what she said if I was in his shoes. And certainly if you do fire her, give her access to the fucking Facebook page. Stop being a bitch. And but if I'm her, I don't know if I sue because you're going to lose. This is not a lawsuit you're going to win. But either way, it's an ugly split. And I tend to lean a little bit more on Tommy Lahren's side than Glenn Beck's side. but, you know, that's like saying I side more with Jason than Freddy Krueger or something. Okay, final story of the day, y'all. Let's do it. So Sean Hannity is no genius, as virtually everybody in the audience knows. He's really just a silly person. He takes Republican talking points, puts them on steroids and human growth hormone, and goes out there every day, and like the blockhead he is, just repeats himself. So he really is one of the worst, because at least with some other commentators, you get the sense that they're a little bit more independent thinking, even if they're right-wing hacks. With Sean Hannity, you're talking about no attachment to conservatism, more of an attachment to Republican Party apologetics. And that comes out in so many ways, because he's been a hypocrite on so many issues. So the best example of that is probably the spying program under George W. Bush and it under Obama. So, of course, George Bush starts with the NSA spying, and Hannity at the time says, well, of course I'm in favor of this. What are you, un-American? What do you want, America to be attacked? If you want to protect America and if you care about this country, you're in favor of the NSA program because it's protecting us from the terrorists. That's what he said. Then under Obama, when we learned that that program existed, still exists and, in fact, had been expanded, all of a sudden it was, oh, my God, Fourth Amendment, my Fourth Amendment rights are being violated. We have a right to privacy, and obviously this president is wrong for snooping on everybody. So just on the same issue, just a total 180 based on who was in power, Republican or Democrat. Well, now we have an even clearer example of that. Look at this tweet from Sean Hannity. This is back when Obama was considering in 2013 going into Syria and toppling Assad because of an alleged gas attack. Here's what he said. Glad our arrogant president is enjoying this taxpayer-funded golf outing after announcing the U.S. should take military action against Syria. What just happened? Donald Trump waged an offensive military attack against Syria, and then, as you see on that in that tweet to the right there from Eric Lipton, he went to the golf course the day after. And, in fact, it was the next 2 days in a row he played golf. So Hannity accused Obama, I can't believe you're floating attacking Syria, and then you're going to go play golf. So arrogant. What a bad president. Then Trump actually does attack Syria, the Syrian government, and then he goes golfing 2 days in a row. And what's Sean Hannity do? He's been mass deleting old tweets that show his hypocrisy. Sean, you're just a loser, and you're a hack, and you're a partisan fool. And your whole career and life has been a joke. You're a joke of a human being. There's nothing consistent about you. You're just a liar and you're a hypocrite. And I don't know why anybody takes you seriously. You know, I honestly don't know how guys like Sean Hannity sleep at night. Go look at my rhetoric on Syria under Obama and under Donald Trump. Guess what? It doesn't change. You want to know why? Because I actually have thought about the conflict and I have beliefs on it, and I'm giving you guys the facts, and then I'm giving you my opinion on it. And there's no, I don't sit there and calculate, is it a Democrat in power or a Republican? Because then I'm going to change my position completely. Because I'm not an idiot like you, Sean. Okay. All right, guys. Out of time. Kyle and Corin tomorrow for you at the same time as the live show, 11 o'clock or so. It'll hit YouTube, or it should, although we've had upload problems with it, with Kyle and Corin. But, all right, I love you. You know I love you. And we'll see you tomorrow, and then the live show is back the day after. Mwah. Peace.